Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Hikamo podcast, hosted by myself, William, and co-host Hannah. The Hikamo podcast is all about helping you discover career options by sharing career insights from people working across a range of industries. Today's guest is a legal professional who specializes in blockchain law and governance. He has two law degrees and has worked in multiple countries. On top of his day job, he is also the head of legal for a non-profit organization which helps blockchain organizations to be legally compliant in the ever-changing regulatory landscape. As the field of blockchain continues to grow, it is likely to play a key role in creating jobs of the future. In this episode, we'll be finding out about blockchain, how it works, and what are the potential career and business opportunities it has to offer. Please join us in welcoming Nathan Vandy. Hi, Nathan.
What a kind.
It's great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very, very well, William. Thank you for inviting me, and hey there, Hannah, too.
Pleasure to have you.
Yeah, great. Cool. So, as always, we like to start with a game of two truths and a lie, and we just jump straight into it from the start, and then we get into the questions. So I'm going to hand over to you, Nathan, with your two truths and a lie, please.
Okay, so the first statement is I have worked in four different countries. The second statement is I'm currently doing a PhD in blockchain law and governance. And the last statement is that I've done an international law master's degree. So.
These all sound truthful.
He's played this game before.
Yeah. I think the first one is definitely correct. And I'm going to go with the last one as well.
But is it, it's the number of countries.
Yeah,
it might be more than four.
Four is quite ambitious.
So he's got quite a lot of different countries, because that was going to be some of the questions they were going to ask. PhD. Because I know you did a master's, right, in law. So then probably...
You're thinking about this the right way.
See the next step. And then what did you say? International?
Yeah.
Oh, was it international or European that you did? There might be a difference. Yeah,
it's in the intricacies.
Yeah, I think it might be. I think he's trying to get us here. It's either the number of different countries or international. I'm going to go. Well, Hannah, I'll say mine first. I think the last one's the lie. I think I think it was European rather than international. Hannah, what do you
think?
I think the first one and the last one are correct.
So you think the PhD is a lie?
Yeah.
I think that one's true. What was it in? Blockchain law?
Blockchain law and governance.
Yeah, I think that one's true. I'm going to go for international. I should check my notes. But I'm not going to cheat. Four different countries. I don't know whether four is correct. Hold on. So what was it? Four different countries you've worked in?
I've worked in
lived?
Four different...
Okay.
Worked so, and lived in four different countries.
Okay, so Switzerland, and Amsterdam, then... UK. Oh, what's the fourth one?
Germany.
Okay, so that one's true. Yeah, I think the last one's the lie. International. I think you did European law rather than international law.
And I respect your power of deduction.
Yes.
Well.
Yeah. So I've worked in four different countries: England, UK, Netherlands in Maastricht, and Germany and Switzerland in Zurich. And then I just recently got accepted to do a PhD in the University of Paris in a partnership with Harvard and a European university in Italy. And I didn't do international law, but European law for my master's degree.
Fantastic.
Yeah, congratulations, by the way, on your PhD.
Appreciated.
Massive achievement.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard work there, I assume.
How long
does it last?
It lasts 3 or 4 years, depending on how I balance it, because I'm going to be working whilst I'm doing it on the side. And they basically give you 4 years to write a book. which is quite an exciting thing to do, yeah, to be honest. And it's always been on my bucket list, actually, since I was, since I found out what a PhD even was, like when I was like 7, 8. So it's cool to finally be able to do it.
You have to come up with like an initial question, and then you then do research and deduct things about that question, or is it just a topic and then you write the book about the topic?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. And to be honest, the way that it's worked is that there's a European research center where they've outlined a few projects that they want to go into. And one of the really big ones was blockchain. And my actual PhD advisor, she's the one that set up this whole research project, and she's onboarded a few PhD students to look into it. And she has the focus of using blockchain technology as a regulatory tool. So what does that mean? Regulators, when they are applying laws, want to make sure that interactions with people are transparent. There's auditability in like how people are dealing with things. So like, is there a paper trail, and is there accountability? So when someone does something, is there some person that can actually be identified? And with blockchain, it's really good for transparency, as we'll get into soon. It's good for auditability because all the transactions and interactions are pseudonymously saved onto a database that everyone can see. But when it comes to accountability, it's quite difficult because you can choose to be what's called pseudonymous, which means your identity is hidden. So one of the things that we're going to do in the PhD is explore how blockchain can still be used as a regulatory tool, even though some of the features of blockchain might limit its ability to be used by regulators.
That is a fascinating topic. For those that may not know, could you just define what blockchain is?
Yeah, of course. So blockchain basically is a source of truth. To break it down, it's a decentralized ledger technology. And how does it create this source of truth? Well, first and foremost, the decentralized aspect of blockchain means that it is connected to nodes or computers all around the world. So instead of one company or person holding and managing the database, it's managed and controlled by hundreds, thousands of people all around the world who provide their computer processing power and their connection to the internet to be able to make sure that this database is upheld.
Amazing.
Second of all, it's a ledger. So the ledger is basically a tool that's been used since the dawn of time. Whenever we wanted to be able to know how much someone owed something, we'd make a mark on it so that everyone can say, okay, you look to this ledger and I owe William £10 and he owes me a goat. And on that, ledger, we'll probably put the date as well that it was owed, and maybe even the time when it's owed next. And over time, this ledger has gone from being written on stone walls to when the printing press happened, it started being written in papers. And now that technology has evolved, now we use Excel for ledgers. And it actually acts as a database. So it stores the data for everyone to be able to see. And the ledger that is used in blockchain technology for a lot of the different implications and the different uses of it, stores the different transactions that happen between the different individuals. And that's the ledger side of it. And the technology side of it is what allows this magical process to work of this decentralization and the ledger to be reconciled. And that's something called a consensus mechanism. Consensus obviously means that people agree on the source of truth. And the way that it's used in the first iteration of blockchain with Bitcoin was the proof of work. So the technology sends off a puzzle whenever a transaction happens, and the computer solves the puzzle. And out of these thousands of computers maintaining this blockchain database, the first computer that solves the puzzle verifies it. And what they do is they send it to the network to say, I've solved this puzzle. And then everyone else says, okay, all right, that guy won. And then they send him a reward for doing so, a Bitcoin. And then they put that transaction into the database. And
that's fascinating.
Wow. That's literally the way that blockchain works.
And how quickly are you seeing the field of blockchain grow? In terms of, because in a short space of time, so many people are now starting to talk about, you know, cryptocurrencies, blockchain, all of NFTs as well. I think that comes into it. But kind of being in that space and in that field, how quickly are you seeing it grow? And then kind of where do you see it going? Do you see it replacing existing banking structures? Or do you see it just kind of complementing or being kind of running in parallel? Where do you see that going and kind of the economic impact?
I think it's a really, really good question. And you know that a technology is reaching its point of no return, where it's going to be part of our infrastructure, when people use the technology but don't understand how it works. So for example, if I ask you to explain how the internet works and how us all in different places are able to talk to each other through a video conferencing platform, which is connected to a database, which feeds to all of our individual computers, people would be like, actually, yeah, how does that work? We don't know, but we just use it. And that's the point that's happening now with a lot of these technologies, where there's people that are able to have crypto wallets, send cryptocurrencies, but they don't actually understand how cryptocurrencies work in the first instance. And that for me already shows you that it's becoming an established financial service and product that is going to be part of our lives for forever now. And in your follow-up question in relation to how it's actually affecting the financial industry, well, the first implementation of blockchain technology was Bitcoin, right? In 2008, created by Satoshi Nakamoto. And it was created to allow this ledger to be able to be a source of truth for every time that one person sent a Bitcoin to another person, and it'll be reconciled on this database. And the amazing thing about this is that it created money, but it created what's called social money, in the sense that the only reason why it has value is because we as a society give it value. And that's the same for anything, right? We trust that the government is going to only print a certain amount of sterling and pounds, and that we agree that if I give you a pound and you give it to someone else, it's going to be the same value. It's got fungibility. And that's the same aspect that Bitcoin has, where people now can say, okay, if I give you a Bitcoin, it's going to be worth $50,000 or $40,000. And of course, it hasn't got a stable pricing point at the moment. So some people see it less of money and more as an asset, but it's still got that financial instrument feature, which allows us to hedge against the other currencies which may be deflating. So for example, with the USD and the US dollar, they pump a lot of money and have created a lot of quantitative easing. So there's a lot of dollars, but Bitcoin doesn't change the amount of supply that it has. So by holding Bitcoin over time, you're hedging against any inflation that happens with the money. And these are some of the financial tools that are starting to develop out of blockchain technology due to its very unique economic setup, or tokenomic setup, as people say.
Yeah, and in terms of tools are being created, and kind of comparisons in terms of, I think, Bitcoin being compared to gold in that there's limited supply, whereas money is kind of dependent on what the banks in terms of how they control the supply or the government.
Yeah.
But in terms of, as well as creating tools, are you seeing new jobs and areas within that sector that are being created? And where would you say kind of people that are exploring career options, what sort of jobs or areas within relation to blockchain should they be looking into?
Yes, really good question. And I think first and foremost, it's good to understand that we're in 2021 right now. Blockchain first came out in 2008. And since that time, a plethora of new applications have arisen, especially with the creation of Ethereum, which is basically a supercomputer where anyone can create their own cryptocurrency based on the Ethereum network and create their own community around that. It's allowed a lot of people to become entrepreneurs in these areas and create business models around a token and say, okay, if you're using or you're in my community, we use this token to be able to interact with each other. So you're seeing people being able to create money in a way that wasn't possible beforehand. And it wasn't easy to do beforehand, but because of this shared source of truth on the blockchain, we can all know who owes what, who's transacting with who, and have a way to have digital scarcity, which is really, really exciting. So I would say the first area that people can start to get jobs is as an entrepreneur. So have an idea and then seeing if blockchain can be used to enhance the idea, if a coin can be used to enhance the idea. Obviously, we're talking about technology, so developers can get into this area as well. And it is a very lucrative industry to get into as a developer with about 2-3 years experience. If you're good, you can get 6-figure salaries. It's a very competitive job right now, especially the top tier developers in the area. Obviously, everything that comes around setting up a business, so whether it's marketing or operations or law, all businesses need these standard business departments. So if you have an interest in, I'll say if you're interdisciplinary, so if you're someone who likes economics, if you're someone who likes technology, if you're someone who likes politics, then blockchain is perfect for you. Psychology, not that much, but a bit of philosophy for sure. Yeah, philosophy is definitely inside it. All of this is baked into blockchain and understanding how it can create a shift in roles and functions that was first seen only with the government. So making money, for example, right? That was only in governments, creating democracies, that was only in governments. Blockchain has allowed us to make our own political parties, make our own economies with these technologies. Clearly, very exciting.
I think you sold me a career in blockchain.
Definitely. Yeah. So if you're, yeah, it just allows you to be a jack of all trades and master of one. You're just the master of blockchain.
Do you trade cryptocurrency yourself?
I don't trade, but I invest. So I'm quite a sustainable investor because I've got quite an addictive personality. So if I start trading, that's all I will do.
Yeah.
So instead, what I do is something called dollar cost averaging, where I put aside some of my income every month to invest into cryptocurrencies. And over time, it just has a compounding effect so that, so that you can eventually get financial freedom. I think that's the goal for, I think, everyone and in the world. And that's one of my missions, actually, for more people to get financial freedom. I first heard about law when I was 13, 14, and I was always rather good at English language and English literature, and I was amazing at history. I loved history. I loved learning about people's history, learning about different countries' history. And because when you know where people came from, you can know where they're going. But when it actually came to me going to university, I actually wanted to do history as my university degree. But if you're like me and you come from a West African background, your parents are very educationalist and they want you to have a job which is guaranteed, a career where you're guaranteed a job afterwards. And my mom persuaded me not to do history, but to do law. And at the beginning, I was a bit disgruntled, but eventually I got the realization that law forces you to study the history of laws itself, because you have to learn about where law came from, how all humans developed law, from when we were all in tribes, right? And we had a chief who was the judiciary, legislature, and executive, until our communities grew and we had to develop these laws to make sure that not just one person was creating and delivering these laws. So I was able to get my cake and eat it in that sense. And law is really fascinating because it's got so many different areas you can get into. So you can get into family law, for example, where you help people who are having struggles with their family or if they're having a divorce. You can get into IT law, where you support with maybe data protection or different contracting between IT vendors. You can get into one of the most popular, which is commercial law, where you're looking at business transactions between big companies and how to structure these companies. So it's very, very wide. And I took a while to actually specialize once I finished my university degree. I actually went, it was actually on the eve of Brexit. And I hadn't actually chosen what direction I wanted to go in law. And I was online, surfing online one of these days, and I saw that one of the most asked questions after Brexit is, what is the EU? And for me, I was completely baffled. I said to myself, how can we as a country leave?
It's dumbfounding, honestly. No, it's insane.
How can we leave a whole some people call it boys club, some people call it a committee, but it's basically an agreement to work together with countries and not even understand what we're leaving. So I said to myself that, look, I'm going to study this more deeply. And this is when I went to start to do a master's in European law. And it was amazing. It's very different from UK law, which I studied first, in a sense that you have to study loads of other different jurisdictions as well. So you're studying Germany, German law, you're studying Dutch law, you're studying French law, and you're comparing the nuances in all of these different laws. And then you're also studying European law, which is the red thread that is in between these laws that enable things like the freedom of movement. So for example, in Europe, you can go from one country to another without any passport. All you need is your ID card. You don't need any sort of visa. And this is called the Schengen Agreement. So all of these countries came together and they wrote an agreement and said, look, because we're working together in the European Union, if you're in the European Union, you can travel to any of these countries. And that's why UK was in this fast queue in airports. Well, there was the European Union queue, right? When you go on flights and everyone else is in the 3-hour long international queue.
Now we're back there again.
And I won't tell you some of the nightmares I've had recently, like with my misanticipation of timing now, missing flights because of that. But it just showed you the power of having these agreements and working together, right? And then when I was studying, doing my master thesis, what was really exciting is this is when Bitcoin started to rise to 20,000. This was in 2017. and it was in quite a few news outlets, and I was in between doing a thesis on Brexit and the legal and economic implications, but I was so fascinated by the financial sovereignty of being able to send money from my phone to your phone without the need of a bank. That blew my mind, that instead of looking at political sovereignty that the UK was fighting over, which I thought was a bit populist and it was a bit nationalistic, I moved towards looking at financial sovereignty and data sovereignty that was in Bitcoin and blockchain technology. And I did my master thesis on data protection implications in blockchain networks. And this is when I jumped down the blockchain rabbit hole and
I haven't left since. Yeah. Now, it's amazing that you sort of looked at current affairs and how that would be reflective in your career choice and where you could best place yourself. I feel like that's really good advice for people that are listening, and even for myself when I'm looking at careers, because you know that you're always going to be basically very, very useful within the industry that you've chosen because of the research that you've undertaken. So you went to university. Was there any other route that you could have taken to get into blockchain looking now back in hindsight? Or is like doing a law degree the only way basically?
Yeah, I believe when you're studying law, it's not like other practices. So for example, as a developer, it's very easy to learn it by yourself. There's a lot of tools out there for you to do so. With law, if you don't have a strong grounding at the beginning, you're not going to be able to provide people with sound legal advice. Law is not something that you can hack together like you can hack together a website, right? Like if it goes wrong, if a website goes wrong, then someone might not be able to access a website for a few days. But if it goes wrong with law, you could be sending someone to jail, or you could be mismanaging thousands or millions of people's money. So if you're actually looking to get into law, then the recommended route is simply to just go through to law school. If you want to go to study law on a corporate level, it's actually recommended that you go to a training in a law firm. This usually lasts for 2 years, and then after you have to take, or during, you'll take something called an LPC, a practice course, and then you can become a solicitor after. But this isn't the only route to get into law. You can also take a degree and then do work experience and do something called an SQE, which is a solicitor's qualification exam. And as part of this, you also have to have a 2-year training period, and it has to get signed off by a solicitor that you've done certain tasks that show that based on your law degree and also the work that you've done, you are of a reputable character and a level to actually supply law services as a qualified lawyer. And then you have to take an exam called the SQE1, which is a multiple choice question paper, but do not be mistaken that this is easy. it's not easy at all. They throw you off of a lot of questions that could be right but not quite right. So similar to the game that we played at the start, actually.
I was about to say that. It sounds a bit like two truths and a lie.
Precisely. They would be experts at that game. So there's that route, there's the LPC route, there's the SQE route, if you want to become a solicitor, qualified solicitor, but then you can also become a barrister as well. And a barrister is the people that you typically see at courts, defending people. But this is the UK way of it, of working, by the way. Every jurisdiction around the world has their own process of creating qualified lawyers.
As you've studied, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. So did you have any work experience while you was at university? Obviously, you've done some research about you and you completed an internship. How was that valuable to your sort of career progression? And did you meet any mentors along the way that helped you to get into where you are today?
Yeah, definitely. So I was quite lucky in the sense that my dad had a friend who worked in law. It wasn't the area of law that I wanted to get into, it was immigration law. But I did this at the age of 16. And this was my first like step into just understanding how law works. And he was a sole practitioner. He had his clients and he had his small office and he just worked solo. And getting these experiences of how law actually worked and the different styles of doing legal work, different areas of doing legal work were amazing. And I think I did, I think, six internships in law. During my law degree, I worked in what's called a legal office, the university's legal office, where we provided legal support to people that couldn't afford legal advice. So we helped people with rent issues. And we supported people with tort law issues when their neighbors were annoying them. So already it gave me it allowed me to apply the learnings that I was doing. But when I came out of university, I didn't actually go get a training with a law firm straight away. So I actually had to look for my first training after my law degree myself. And what I did is I printed off my CV with all the work experience that I'd collected during university. And I gave out 20 CVs around my area. And only one person actually replied, and all you need is one. So I had a high street practice where I was able to do criminal and international commercial law. But and I don't advise this but he didn't actually pay me for 3 months during the time. And for me, I knew that I had to take this risk to be able to get the experience that I needed. Obviously, there are a lot of law firms that do pay their interns and go for those if you can. But I was at the position where beggars can't be choosers. So what I did is I was training with him from 9 to 5. And in the evenings, I would actually work at a burger restaurant so that I would be able to get some money to just do what I need to do, right? So 9 to 5, I'd be in my suit working in law, and then I would change into my apron and serve people at a burger joint in the evening. And I did this for 2 summers so I could get the necessary work experience that I needed to be able to eventually become qualified. And it was not easy at all, but it was the necessary work that I needed to do to get where I needed to go.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think now, I thought it was illegal for, I think it's a certain amount of time, but they have to start paying you if you're doing work experience now. So I feel like for the listeners, if you're getting an internship or any sort of work experience, I think they have to pay you now. If it's like a 3 month period, because that's quite substantial.
Exactly.
But it's very resilient of you to have kept doing that, even not being paid, just for the experience aspect.
Yeah. He gave me a token amount at the end, which was like how much I'd earn for one weekend at the burger.
Wow.
But it was a situation where I wasn't doing it for the money.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of people don't realize at the beginning. Like when you do things for free, quote unquote free, at the beginning of your career, as long as you're doing it with a hustling mentality where you understand I'm doing it because I need to learn this at the beginning, after you've got that experience, then you can start billing them up. Because you actually know how the whole system works, you know how to provide that service, you've worked with experienced lawyers, and you're able to go from there.
Yeah, and it's having that long-term view as well, long-term vision as well, right? So in the short term, obviously not saying do it for free, but let's say you're not getting paid as much as you could working somewhere else. But actually, if you've got that long-term view where actually you can take a bit less in the short term, knowing where it's going to get you to, and the knowledge you probably were able to take from that or learn from that individual.
Precisely.
That gave you that opportunity. So I think that's really useful advice. And why did you target local firms? Because I think this is a good point. I think it's good that you went locally, because I think a lot of the time, just naturally when people are looking for jobs, they're kind of looking more in central London if they live in London or in the UK, or they're kind of looking for some of the big, large corporations, organizations. What made you target local firms?
Yes. Yeah, so for example, one of the main things was that I couldn't actually afford to move. So I was staying at my grandma's at this time, actually. And I wanted to be able to commute to work easily and have the second job in the area that I was at. So the law firm was very close to the burger restaurant.
It was about proximity.
Convenience.
Yeah, it was proximity.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was a big element to it as well. And in the area that I was working, there was certain law firms that was not just doing small cases, but international commercial work as well. So even though I wasn't working at one of these magic circles that was doing $1 million deals, I was still able to work in bigger cases, which gave me the experience which I needed. So you have to be very, in my case, I was quite lucky because that was the only one that chose me, but you should look at the different areas that the law firms that you're applying to while practicing, because I've heard some really amazing stories of people that started off at high street firms and then are now working for really big top US firms in the future, because it's not about where you start at all, but it's about the things that you learn, because they can't take that away from you. The same experience you can get from a local law firm, if you have the right mentality and the right proficiency and productivity, you're going to be doing very similar work to some of the people in the top law firms. There's not that much of a change in that sense.
Yeah, I feel like that's quite a common thing as well, where people have done work experience and they've said when they go for the smaller companies, they have a more hands-on experience and it's more one-to-one, as opposed to just sort of trailing around making teas and whatnot. Like, people actually cater to you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Really, really, really good point.
And then how did you go from kind of working locally in the UK to now working, I guess, internationally?
Really, really good point. I credit that a lot to the master's degree. So through the master's degree, I started working in the Netherlands, supporting a Dutch company. And then I was really focusing on the European level of things, so how European law applied to the companies. And immediately, once you start working on the European level, you're working on an international level. It's beautiful. So when I went to do my next internship during my master's at Lafarge Holcim, which is an international cement manufacturing company, they're literally everywhere. That's when I went from doing European law to international financial regulation law. And I was working in their compliance department. I was supporting them in the EMEA area, so the European, Middle East, and African area, and looking at all the international regulations that applied to them doing transfers of financial transactions, and how anti-bribery law as well. And this is when I started doing law and compliance on the international level. And then I started working with the GDPR as well. And then once you work with GDPR and international financial regulation, you're gone. You can work anywhere.
Working in multiple countries, how have you found it in terms of language barrier, language challenges? Are you multilingual? How have you managed that?
Yeah, so working in Europe is not easy for someone from the UK, because whether you like it or not, underneath, a lot of us have this mentality that we don't have to learn another language because we speak the language that everyone else speaks. So there's not a lot of people that go out of their way to learn a new language in the UK. But simply by living in Europe, I was forced to change that mentality. So, for example, I started learning French and I started learning German just on a conversational level so that I can hold discussions with people. But to learn it on a business level, it takes a long time. And the main work I was doing was mainly international law. And if there was any specific national law, I would work alongside a qualified lawyer in that jurisdiction to make sure that the business needs were met of that law. And this is what a lot of global legal counsels have to do anyway. So if you're a global legal counsel of a company where your company is in different areas, you'll never be able to know all of the different laws in all of those different areas. But as a legal counsel, you have at least a 40% understanding of how all of those laws work, and at least a high level overview of it. And then you understand the business needs as well. That's another 40%. And then the last 20% that's needed, you get the expert counsel in that jurisdiction or in that domain area to work with you so that you make sure that there's no legal loopholes, it's legally watertight. But typically, in the roles that I've had as a counsel, that's what I would do. I would really understand the business, really understand the laws on a very high level, and then work with individuals for certain domains that are outside of my expertise.
Amazing.
Yeah, I think that's really useful though, because a lot of people would probably be put off of working in a different country because they think that they have to really learn the language and become fluent. But you've kind of demonstrated there is a way of managing that. So as long as you have the basics in the language, you can work with a wider team to be effective in your role.
Yeah, okay, great. Definitely so. And I think this is something that every lawyer has to learn to do. They have to learn to deal with what's called external counsel. So when you're working with a client, you're never always going to know every single area for them. This is why law firms are so massive, because they've got different departments that focus in different areas. So you don't have to go outside of your law firm to get the expertise. It's inside the law firm already. You literally just walk down the road and say, "Oh, Jimmy, I know you're good with employment law. Can you help me with this? Because I'm doing this contract for this company." But when you're a legal counsel, you don't have that same network. So you have to build it up yourself. So you have to build up a network of specialized individuals in different areas that can support you in different roles.
Cool. In terms of having then that, so you've mentioned a few of the key skills. So having that holistic knowledge of business law, etc., for the role that you work in now, so blockchain law, what would you say maybe three key skills required?
One of the main ones is you have to be entrepreneurial, in the sense that a lot of the time I put the hat of a CEO on. So I say, what does the CEO want to achieve in this period of time, in this roadmap, and what are the legal challenges that need to be solved in order to do that? So you have to have a very strong business and legal mindset and know how to understand those risks and find solutions for them. So yeah, first, very entrepreneurial, some people say commercially aware. Second of all, it's very solution orientated. And I would say the last one is very confident. Like, the more confident you are, the more positive things will come to you. And that's not to say that you won't have imposter syndrome when you're first beginning. That's natural, but you have the confidence that first and foremost, you're standing on the shoulders of giants. So a lot of the body of work of law that was done before you has been done by other humans just like you. And also every head of an international company was a junior legal counsel at one time as well. So you just have to build up that experience, skill set, work with other lawyers as well in the other areas that are going through similar situations, and yeah, just confidently approach your task.
Amazing. And on a day-to-day, what would you say your sort of typical job role is? What does it consist of?
No day is the same. So a lot of the work that I have to do is staying on top of evolving regulations, laws and regulations. So especially in the blockchain industry, the laws are changing quite quickly, and you have a few main jurisdictions which the company that you're working with is operating out of that you have to be aware of. So it's quite interesting. When you're working with a blockchain project, typically it has different entities in different jurisdictions. Sometimes it has an entity in Europe, and it might have an entity in the Cayman Islands, for example. And depending on which jurisdiction you're in, there's going to be different compliance and licensing requirements that you always have to be on top of. So that's one of the main things. So creating reports on how the laws are changing. Another thing is contract drafting as well. So obviously, as the business is evolving and you're creating new contacts with people and clients, we have to facilitate the drafting process to make sure that the rights and interests and responsibilities between the two parties are balanced at all times. So that takes a lot of empathy, being in the other person's shoes, understanding what they want to achieve, understanding what you want to achieve, and understanding what the common goal is. Another one that is I'm doing more now is actually managing other paralegals as well. So one of the things that I really struggled with initially is delegation, because I want to do everything. But I've got very, very lucky, because I've got a really good team around me who help with the operational side, and then help with often a lot of legal research and drafting. And after a while, I've been better at being able to offload work to them and see them start to become self-starters as well, which is something really, really exciting too. And then the last one is a lot of client work. So client care, where, for example, if we're working with a client on a project that they're working with, I often do workshops with them where the goal is to explain the law in a layman's term, so that it's not that they're just outsourcing all of the legal work and they have no clue what's going on. That's the worst thing. You want them to have a level of understanding of what you're doing. And it's not to say that you become indispensable. They rely on you to be able to constantly be providing them with that information and updating on them. So you have to be a teacher as well. I teach a lot of law to the clients as well, so that they're in the know too.
Cool. And off the back of that, so you've said about client care and whatnot, and obviously your job does involve a lot of traveling. So then how has COVID impacted your role? And does a lot of the work now just happen via Zoom, or do you still need that face-to-face in-person interaction?
Yeah, I really struggled during COVID because of my personality is quite open, and I like to meet with people in person. But my work didn't suffer. If anything, there was more work to do because you were more accessible. And that's one thing you have to learn to do as well, actually understand how accessible you make yourself. But COVID, if anything, accelerated the digitization of the workforce and ushered in the new normal, which is us working remotely. There's some of my colleagues that I've never met in person before. It was really exciting, actually. I was working with one colleague for 3 months, and I decided to see a friend in Finland, and my colleague also lived in Finland, and we actually met for the first time. And these are really, really amazing experiences, but this is just the new normal of the way things work now. And I think also COVID accelerated the development of a blockchain application called Decentralized Autonomous Organizations, which are organizations that facilitate themselves around a common goal and use a cryptocurrency to be able to govern that organization. So it's really, really cool. And the reason why I'm linking the COVID incident and how we are all working online to this is that with these organizations, you can literally go to their website, you can go to their forum, and you can see everything that the organization is doing. It's very transparent. Complete transparency. You just go to the website, you can see, okay, we're working on this project, we're working on this project, we're working on that project. And we have this treasury. So treasury is like a bank, right? So the organization is literally a forum, an online forum, connected to this blockchain-based bank. And then anyone can go on a forum and say, I have this really good idea that's going to help the organization, and I would like a certain amount of money for a certain period of time to be able to do that. And you can literally say to the community this proposal, they will criticize it, say where it can be improved. And often at the times, as long as it's sound and it makes sense, they will typically maybe give you a bit of the money at the beginning. And then once you prove yourself, they'll start to give you more money so you can continue to contribute to the organization.
And of course, surreal.
Everything is transparent. Everything's based on crypto wallets as well. So it's just connecting with each other through crypto wallets and through the organization's bank to the crypto wallet. And you just help to build up the organization into becoming what it is. And it's a new way of working that hasn't really caught the zeitgeist. So it's not really you will never hear people talking about it in schools.
It's not mainstream yet. Yeah, it's not mainstream yet.
Precisely. But people are starting to really build a few ramps to make it easier for people to understand and work in these areas. And I'm working on some of the legal issues of how to deal with this type of organization structure type as well. So I think COVID accelerated this organization type and way of working becoming a new norm in the next few years. So definitely look out for that.
It just goes to show the entrepreneurial aspect is very, very key, because like you said, you could pitch an idea. If other people are on board, you would get the funding for it. It's incredible.
We've got the three sentences that we always ask our guests to complete. So I'm gonna jump into those. So the first one is, success to me means.
Yeah, it's changed for me recently, actually. This is why I'm having a slight existential crisis about it. Because beforehand, it was success to me was working on cutting edge technology and changes in the world, which are going to make the world a better place and usher in the new future that we're living in. That was the main thing. But I think after a while, I was so obsessed with this idea of success that I forgot that success is actually being able to have enough time to spend with your family and loved ones. And it's very, very easy to get caught in that rabbit hole and forget that balance. So I would say success is being able to work on what is going to change the world for a better place, whilst also keeping like your family Family life, like, really strong as well. So I never neglecting that. That would be the best balance for me. Yeah.
Great answer. And I think what I like about that answer is that it's showing that people's perspective of success can change over time. So thank you for sharing that. And then the next one is, I'd wish I'd known about
Bitcoin when it first started. That's because, not because necessarily of the money situation, but because of the fact that I would have become more of a developer as well. Because I really, really like development, and I like the ability to be able to create your own futures. And as a lawyer, you get to support people creating their own futures. But as a developer, you really get to create new applications, new products that can be used by hundreds, thousands, and millions of people around the world. And that's really exciting. But it's the thing that I'm learning on the side as well. It's never too late to learn, regardless.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And then the last one is, the best advice I could give.
The best advice I can give is, let it come to you. Always let it come to you. Because no matter how much you try to plan out your life, eventually that serendipitous moment will come where you say, actually, this is what I want to do. I love the fact that, for example, Vincent van Gogh, he had five careers that he thought was his calling until he became an artist, where he picks up an elementary book of how to draw, and then he started from there in his late 20s, and then he became the legend he is today. And he just did that by letting it come to him. If you got the passion for something, hit the road, go hard. But then just, if something else comes that really grabs you and you can see you can put in the same amount of high level of energy into it, then do it. We don't live in a world where you have to be in the same career for your whole lifetime anymore. Like, those days are gone. So yeah, let it come to you.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and so I think from here then we're going to lead into the end of the show. Thank you so much. Some really great insight into blockchain, law, your whole career journey, really inspiring. So thank you so much for sharing that with us and the audience.
Thanks a lot.
Would you like to share where people could find you on social media if they want to reach out?
For sure. On my LinkedIn, I share quite a bit of work that I do in law and blockchain and governance. So definitely check me out there. On my Twitter, it's definitely more crypto and legal developments and just ideas about how to change the world in that sense. So you can follow me on Twitter at VandyNathan. And I won't be sharing my Instagram handle.
Okay. Okay, good stuff. Thank you. So I'm going to hand over to Hannah to see us out, but thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much for that very informative insight into blockchain law. Thank you guys for listening and for watching today's episode. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe to the Hikomo channel. Let us know if there's any other career content you would like to see. And until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
It's smooth.